Deutsche Welle Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn. Coming up, an outcry in Nigeria over the failure of the government and the military to protect the 100 schoolgirls abducted by suspected Islamist militants.
We are calling them with strong voice. They ought to know that it is human beings that we are missing, and let them walk without fear or favor. So much so that those children's family will feel that, yes, justice is being done to them.
And in South Africa, criticism of an expert witness for the defence at the trial of Oscar Pistorius.
The first thing that he did wrong was he professed his knowledge on so many different fields. Now, you're testifying about this, but you're not even properly qualified on it.
Stay with us for the next 25 minutes.
Top story.
The principal of the school in Borno State, Nigeria, where more than 100 schoolgirls were abducted before dawn on Tuesday, has said she was shocked to hear claims by the military that only 8 of the girls were still missing. She explained that most of the girls were still unaccounted for and only 14 had been found. Conflicting claims about the girls' whereabouts have triggered anger and bewilderment among parents, as our correspondent in northeastern Nigeria, Al-Amin Mohammed, reports.
Borno State Government and the management of Government Girls Secondary School GGSS Chibok, where over 100 girls were abducted by suspected Boko Haram gunmen, have refuted the military's claim on the freeing of 107 girls. The spokesman of the Defense Headquarters, Brigadier General Chris Olukolade, issued a statement on Wednesday claiming that 107 of the kidnapped girls had been freed. General Olukolade added that one of the terrorists who carried out the attack on the school has also been captured, and said that efforts were underway to locate the remaining 8 students. But the principal of the girls' school, Mrs. Asabe Kambura, insisted that only 14 of the abducted girls had been freed, as announced earlier by Governor Kashim Shettima. Many residents of Maiduguri, who are angered by the sad development, feel this denial has laid bare the truth on how the military may have been feeding the public with false claims of victories in their campaigns against Boko Haram insurgents. Muhammad Bello, a political analyst in northeastern Nigeria, says military should stop taking human lives for granted.
The military, they're just playing with the lives of innocent citizens as far as I'm concerned. They have felt woefully as far as I'm concerned, and they don't want to admit they have felt, but as far as I'm concerned, they have felt. In a situation where the military headquarters will come out and say something that is far from true, oh, no, I think this is a great failure, not only to the military, but to the Nigerian state as a whole. All hands must be on deck, because security issue, I think, is a collective responsibility, not only to the military, to the police or the SSS. All hands must be on deck to see the end of this insurgency in this country.
Human rights activist Muhammad Abdullahi called on the military and the Nigerian government to do all they can to secure the release of the innocent girls.
We are calling them with strong voice. To now, I realize that they are working for Nigerians. So they ought to know that it is human beings that we are missing, and let them walk without fear or favor, affection or ill will, so much so that those children's family will feel that, yes, justice is being done to them. Let them do their best, but let them not be hiding something, unless if they have skeleton in their cupboard.
Borno State Governor Kashim Shettima has offered a 50 million naira, an equivalent of $300,000, as a reward to anyone with information leading to the return of the schoolgirls.
Al-Amin Mohammed reporting. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan summoned his security chiefs for a meeting on Thursday to review the country's chronic insecurity. In a rare move, he also invited all of Nigeria's 36 state governments to join a second security meeting later in the day. Our correspondent in Abuja is Ben Shamang, and I asked him what had come out of these meetings.
Well, at the governors, when they came out of this meeting, they just said they discussed security matters, bearing in mind that of recent, there have been a number of attacks here and there, Abuja bombing, then the kidnapping of these students in Chibok, and of course some other killings within the country. So by next week again, there's going to be an enhanced meeting of all the governors again.
Do you get the impression that the anger being voiced by parents of the missing children is having some impact on the government?
Yes, it has, bearing in mind that we're talking of children who ordinarily were in their sleep, innocent students, and of course that the parents are so disturbed. And any government that is responsive to people's cries, of course, will feel disturbed. And that's why the president is also meeting with these security chiefs and giving them the marching order. By all means, every child should be released.
Is the schoolgirl's fate now a political issue in Nigeria? Has the opposition been criticizing the way the government is handling this?
Honestly, in Nigeria, everything is just being politicized. And bearing in mind that the year 2015, when you have elections into offices of governor, offices of president and vice president, people are just turning everything to be political. I give you an example. The opposition governors decided to visit victims of Nyanya bombing, and they set up a trust fund for victims. In other words, the ruling party should also set its own kind of a trust fund. So you can see a kind of a divide in terms of having sympathy, if it is a sympathy that way. It ought not to be so. It's supposed to be a collective kind of a thing. And the whole game is all tailored towards 2015. They want to outsmart one another. This side is doing well, this side is not doing well. But again, Nigerians are actually condemning this. We ought to see leaders talking in unison, and their actions are one and beneficial to everybody, particularly the victims.
I understand the state of emergency in the three states in the northeast of Nigeria is about to expire. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, Mark, it's about expiring, but again, there's this huge line of divide between government and opposition. And even some elders from Borno State who have come to see the president, they are saying that the state of emergency as it is currently going on shouldn't be extended. This is also part of the discussions these security chiefs have discussed, the same thing with the governors and, of course, the National Council of State presided over by the president.
Ben Shemang in Abuja.
Africa Link, because Africa is more than just a headline.
In Guinea-Bissau, the presidential election goes to a second round on May the 18th. This comes after a vote last Sunday failed to produce an outright winner. The election marked the first presidential and parliamentary polls in the West African nation since a military coup in 2012. And almost three-quarters of Guinea-Bissau's eligible voters turned out to cast their ballots. This report by Johannes Beck, head of DW's Portuguese language service, has been adapted for Africa Link by Crispin Wakideo.
It is a clear victory for Guinea-Bissau's former liberation movement, Party for the Independence of Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde, PAIGC. According to preliminary results announced by the country's Electoral Commission, PAIGC won a total of 55 of the 102 parliamentary seats. That means they can rule with an absolute majority. However, the battle for the presidency continues with a runoff planned for May the 18th. That's because no candidate secured enough votes for a first-round win, the president of the Electoral Commission, Augusto Mendes, said while announcing the results.
In primeiro lugar temos José Mário Vaz.
In the first place is José Mário Vaz, the candidate from the PAIGC. Second place goes to Nuno Gomes, who is running as an independent candidate. Third slot was taken by Paulo Fernando Gomes, another independent candidate. Fourth place is Abel Incada from the PRS party.
Abel Incada, do PRS.
Vaz garnered 41% of the total ballots cast in the first round of voting, which took place simultaneously with the parliamentary elections. With the president and parliamentary majority coming from the PAIGC, there are hopes of a stable government which could bring to an end the chronic instability which has troubled Guinea-Bissau for decades, says the UN Special Envoy and former president of East Timor, José Ramos Horta.
There seems to be a good climate for the presidential runoff election. There is a great climate for dialogue between the parties, which could lead to the emergence of a strong government, fulfilling the hopes and aspirations of Guineans.
The runoff will now pit Nuno Nabiam, who came second with 25.1%, against José Maria Vaz. Nabiam is considered the candidate preferred by the military. Before the elections, he was asked in an interview with DW whether military reforms were necessary.
I believe a reform of the security sector is really necessary, but it must be well thought through. If there's a real need for reform, this must first be discussed.
With a voter turnout of nearly 80%, the citizens of Guinea-Bissau have sent a clear message that they have had enough of the political instability and the economic recession that followed the military coup of April 2012.
That report was written by Johannes Beck. Next to South Africa, at the murder trial of Paralympian Oscar Pistorius, the prosecution has been challenging the credibility of an expert witness for the defence. The defence is trying to prove that the athlete killed his girlfriend, Reeva Steenkamp, by mistake. The witness, Roger Dixon, conceded he was not an expert on some of the areas about which he had been testifying. From Pretoria, Tuzo Kamalo reports.
The cross-examination of Roger Dixon, the third defence witness in the trial of Oscar Pistorius, centred mostly on the location of a magazine rack on the day that Reeva Steenkamp was shot by Pistorius. While Pistorius told the court that a magazine rack was not near Reeva when he broke down the toilet door, Dixon contradicted him, saying it was next to where Reeva fell. Dixon told the court bruises on Steenkamp's body probably came from her falling on the rack. It also came out that Dixon failed to ensure that the tests he made to ascertain the amount of light in Pistorius's room and the sequence of the gunshots were done under similar conditions to those that prevailed on the night when Reeva was killed. Dixon also admitted that he did not use any scientific instrument to test the amount of light, but only relied on his eyes.
We switched the lights on and off, drew the curtains and looked at the room in various levels of illumination, my lady.
But that was not all. When he recorded the sound of the gun and cricket bat in a scene he had reconstructed at a shooting range, he used musical equipment and admitted that he was not sure if they amplified the sound or not.
If the sound engineer boosted something on his system to ensure a clean recording, I don't know to what degree it would have been.
State Prosecutor Gerinel criticized Dixon for testifying about forensic matters that were beyond his expertise. Legal expert Ulrich Roux says Dixon's testimony on the fields that are not within his expertise have dented his credibility.
The first thing that he did wrong was he professed his knowledge on so many different fields. Now, you're testifying about this, but you're not even properly qualified on it.
Roux warns that Dixon might have done more damage than good to the version of events as narrated by Pistorius.
In my opinion, his version will be rejected on both the ballistics and the post-mortem findings, and the versions of the state witnesses will be accepted.
The trial has been adjourned until the 5th of May, when the defence is expected to bring its fourth witness.
Tuzo Kamalo reporting.
Deutsche Welle, learning by ear. Listen up, shape your future.
Hello and welcome to the last episode of our new Learning by Ear series on human rights called Human Rights Are Universal and Yet. Today's episode focuses on the right to work. Article 23 of the Declaration says that everybody has a right to work and to do so under just and favorable conditions. This article also guarantees fair payment and the right of workers to form organizations called trade unions to protect their interests. That's the theoretical part. Today, though, we are going to take a look at the reality of work in very harsh conditions. Diamonds hold out the promise of great riches, but not, it seems, for everyone. The precious stones were discovered in Zimbabwe in 2006, but even the diamonds can't seem to rescue the country's failed economy. Instead, diamond mining in Zimbabwe's Marange fields has mainly been associated with reports of physical abuse. People have been trying to survive by panning for stones, and they've been subjected to brutal attacks. According to the reports, these are often carried out by the army. Some people have been killed or maimed, while others are lucky to have escaped with less serious injuries. Yet people still go there to pan for diamonds. Columbus Mavunga has been listening to some of their stories and talking to people who are trying to ensure that the miners' human rights are protected. The report is presented by Victoria Wakio.
We are in a city called Mutare, about 300 kilometers east of the Zimbabwean capital Harare. The flash cars driving by and the people filling the pubs give no indication of the tensions and pain simmering just below the surface. We'll call this 24-year-old man Richard. He knows a lot about working in the mines because he was there right after the diamonds were discovered in 2006. He says he lost a finger when he was badly beaten by army officers. They caught him in the diamond fields and he refused to hand over what he'd mined that day. He shows us the scars all over his body and tells us about the army's activities in the Marange diamond fields.
They were beating people so that if they can beat you, then if you can go, then you don't have to come again. A lot of people were killed. At one time, there were about 7 to 8 corpses in the field. People who would be dead in the field, then people would be just crossing. No one was minding about that.
The abuse Richard is talking about happened some time ago, but that doesn't mean all is now well in the Marange diamond fields.
Now the situation is very tight now. They've managed to enclose a lot of the diamond fields so that the people have got to stay out of the field, and they are using dogs as well outside the fields. In the fire guards across the area, they will be going searching around to see if there are still Gwejazi who are trying to mine the diamond.
Gwejazi are individuals who try to earn a living by panning for diamonds themselves to sell them. They don't work for the few companies the government has contracted to mine the diamonds. So officially, they are not allowed to work in the fields, but they still do it to try to earn a living, and the government is not happy about it. Despite all the evidence to the contrary, the Zimbabwean government denies that its army has committed human rights abuses in the diamond fields, but it has defended the use of the army to prevent illegal panning for diamonds. At this bar in Mutare, these Gwejazi, mainly young men, are drinking to drown their sorrows. Richard is one of them. Richard will continue to pan for diamonds, despite the risks he runs in doing so. He hopes that President Robert Mugabe's government will change the situation. Richard wants Gwejazi to be allowed to mine diamonds. He doesn't think it should be only big companies that are allowed to exploit the mines, as they cannot take all the millions of Zimbabweans who are currently in need of work. Zimbabwe's unemployment rate is more than 85%.
I think the government should make sure that people who are mining diamonds should be mining diamonds in peace, where the soldiers or whatever the government will be taking the responsibility of the people. If people can mine the diamonds, they can give them the diamonds so that they can pay them. Sort of employment, someone needs something to do in order to make a life.
But given the Zimbabwean government's bad record of human rights abuses over the past 2 decades, it seems very unlikely that it will do what Richard wants and allow individuals to mine the diamonds, as well as the major corporations. From where Richard and his fellow Gwejazi are drinking, we drive across the city to the offices of the Center for Research and Development. Since 2006, this NGO has been documenting the goings-on in the controversial Marange diamond fields. The NGO has gathered evidence of some horrific abuse. It says that murder, torture, and forced labor are all still happening there. As a result, Zimbabwe is now being examined by the Kimberley Process, a group of countries and institutions that tries to ensure the diamonds they trade in do not come from areas of conflict. Zimbabwe was even temporarily banned from exporting its diamonds because of these reports. The man behind the Center for Research and Development, or CRD for short, is Farai Maguu. He confirms what Richard told us earlier about the situation in Marange.
We were the first organization to raise an outcry about these abuses. We also assisted victims with access to treatment. We did a lot of advocacy, both locally and internationally, so that government was under intense pressure to make sure that these abuses come to an end. So we are happy that violence has declined, but we are still concerned that the private security guards are continuing to unleash a reign of terror on artisanal miners and the community.
The private security guards he's referring to are people employed by the diamond mining companies. Farai Magu explains that human rights abuses have taken different forms since Zimbabwe discovered the diamonds. When the diamond rush first started in 2006, he says, there were problems with Gwejazi fighting over the gems. Then 2 years later, security guards started robbing the Gwejazi.
And then between November 2008 and around the end of 2010, violence escalated, and this time it was the state security agents, in particular the military. And the violence was varied. There were killings. There were cases of rape, especially in November and December 2008. I think hundreds of women, they suffered rape at the hands of the state security agents.
It's good that people like Farai Magu and his NGO are there to try and protect the human rights of the miners. Even if Article 23 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says that workers have the right to form or join trade unions to protect their interests, these organizations are only there for workers in formal employment, not for the Gwejazi who work on their own. Human rights lawyers in Zimbabwe have represented several activists and journalists in the Marange diamond fields. They believe that those who have been abused or lost relatives in the diamond fields stand a better chance if they sue President Mugabe's government outside Zimbabwe. They say Zimbabwean courts are too compromised to rule against the old leader's government. Back near the bar, we continue the interview with Richard, the 24-year-old diamond miner inside a car with tinted windows. Richard believes that the government should be sued not only for the physical assaults and human rights abuses, but for keeping Zimbabweans in poverty when their country is rich in minerals and gemstones.
I think the government is not trying to improve the lives of the people. They still want to see the people suffering. People, they want to earn something. They've got to mine the diamond, sell the diamond, so that they can actually improve their standards of living. People should mine the diamond so that they can improve their lives.
Richard maintains that Zimbabwe's government would benefit if it allowed individual miners, the Gwejazi, to look for diamonds.
They should leave the Gwejazi to mine. They can actually earn something from the Gwejazi. It's better for them to say this percentage to the government so that the Gwejazi still have something for their lives than they have to be beaten.
In recent years, reports about the serious human rights abuses of people trying to scratch a living from diamond mining have dominated the news in Zimbabwe. But this is just one example of a far bigger global problem. In other countries too, and in other areas of work, people don't always get the chance to exercise their right to work under fair conditions. Around the world, NGOs continue to fight for those rights on their behalf. This is the end of the last episode of our Learning by Ear series about human rights. If you'd like to hear the program again or tell your friends about it, please visit dw.de/LBE. Until next time, goodbye for now.
And before we leave you here on Africa Link, a reminder of our main stories. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has been holding meetings with his security chiefs and state officials following an outcry over the kidnapping of more than 100 schoolgirls in Borno State. The people of Guinea-Bissau are to elect a new president in a runoff election on May the 18th. And in the murder trial of Paralympian Oscar Pistorius, the prosecution has been challenging the credibility of an expert witness for the defence. We look forward to receiving your comments on this programme, either in a text message to country code 49 160 957 595 10, an email to feedback.africa@dw.de, or in a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. And there we come to the end of this edition of Africa Link. Isaac Mugabe will be here tomorrow. Do join him if you can. Until the next time, thank you for listening. This is Mark Caldwell in Bonn.